originally Place Louis XV, and they had that big statue of Louis XV right in the middle, a big copper statue. But like we said, during the Revolution, they took this big copper statue, they melted it down, actually made coin out of it.
According to an old joke, when Mao Zedong was asked what had been the consequences of the French Revolution, he replied that it was too early to tell. I want to go a stage further in this program and ask whether 2 centuries after that bloody revolution, we've yet sorted out even what actually happened, let alone what it led to. I'm standing in the heart of Paris in the Place de la Concorde, surrounded by tourists who have probably not come here to remember the fact that in this vast square, the guillotine was erected, claiming the heads of, amongst many others, King Louis XVI and his wife Marie Antoinette. Think about the French Revolution. Think about the accounts by British writers, Edmund Burke, Thomas Carlyle, and Charles Dickens in his novel A Tale of Two Cities, and you'll inevitably think of Paris and the Reign of Terror.
Along the Paris streets, the death carts rumble, hollow and harsh. 6 tumbrils carry the day's wine to La Guillotine. All the devouring and insatiate monsters imagined since imagination could record itself are fused in the one realization, guillotine.
Pitting his voice, as I am, against the traffic noise here in the centre of Paris is William Doyle, Professor of History in the University of Bristol. These images we have of the tumbrils rolling forward with the victims for the guillotine, these are quite accurate impressions, are they not?
They are accurate impressions of a particular time in the revolution, but they certainly don't encapsulate all that it was about, and they only take place, generally, up to 4 years after the revolution begins, so there's a lot going on before the tumbrils start to roll.
Why was it then that this impression of what happened here in La Place de la Concorde became so riveted in the minds, I think not just of English people, but of people looking at the French Revolution in general?
Well, it's very spectacular. Paris was the centre of civilization of the whole of Europe, and people were very shocked to start with that it could degenerate into such vengeful chaos as it appeared from the outside. Then you have to look at the sort of people who were victims, kings, queens, nobles, spectacular glitterati of the later 18th century, and people were particularly shocked to see them executed in this way, which was actually a very spectacular way of executing anybody, because when the head comes off, blood spurts for feet out from the neck of the victim, and it's well recorded that people found themselves paddling in blood.
In Paris, thick as brown leaves in autumn, rustle and travel the suspects, shaken down by revolutionary committees. They're swept thitherward as into their storehouse to be consumed. La guillotine ne va pas mal. The guillotine goes not ill.
Here in Paris, how many people approximately lost their heads to the guillotine?
We are looking at about 1,500 in Paris, but the thing that we overlook about the terror all the time is its greatest impact was away from Paris in the provinces.
So if it were our ambition to find the bloodiest part of the French Revolution, if it's not Paris, where would we look for that?
There's no doubt at all that it is in the Vendée, the area along the Atlantic coast, inland from the coast, south of Nantes, north of La Rochelle. This is the area where large numbers of the peasantry rebel against the revolution in favour of the king and the church. They would like to have those restored.
The French Revolution was not a single event, but a series of violent and chaotic occurrences. Power transferred to an assembly in Paris called the Convention, within which factions known as Girondins and Jacobins wrestled for control. In late 1793, France's leaders, and particularly the dominant figure Robespierre, unleashed the so-called Reign of Terror. But in this programme, I'm looking at what happened in the Vendée. And according to Alan Forrest of the University of York, the uprising in that province, which came at a time when France was at war with its neighbours, posed such a strategic threat that any political authority in the capital would have felt compelled to crush it.
By the summer of 1793, France is engaged in a war on virtually all its fronts. So an armed rising in the West would appear at that time not just to be a particularly serious deflection for its troops, but a deflection of troops who otherwise should be fighting for the motherland on the frontier to put down a peasant insurrection at home. That creates very bad blood and is, I think, one of the reasons for the anger within the army and the acceptance of extremely vicious measures of repression.
Southwestward, in remote patriarchal La Vendée, the loyal warmth of a simple people is blown into flame and fury by theological and seigneurial bellows, so that there shall be fighting from behind ditches, death volleys bursting out of thickets and ravines of rivers, huts burning, feet of the pitiful women hurrying to refuge with their children on their back, seed fields, fallow, whitened with human bones.
Thomas Carlyle, writing in the 1830s, and ensuring that events in the Vendée didn't go unnoticed in Britain at the time. But nowadays, our thoughts about the revolution do focus on Paris. And to broaden out from that restricted view, I felt I must actually visit the towns and villages of the Midwest, of the Vendée. Before I set off, Bill Doyle was keen that I should understand Carlyle's reference to theological bellows, meaning that I should grasp the importance of the split between the revolutionary government and the Catholic Church, which had happened as early as 1791.
So, Bill, what was your purpose in bringing me to Notre Dame?
Well, the quarrel with the Church went so deep that you have a movement in the summer and autumn of 1793 of de-Christianization, and eventually they close down all churches, they try and strip them of furnishings of one sort or another, and here in Notre Dame, the most famous church in Paris, they hold a festival of reason, and they have a goddess, a woman embodying reason, who sits in the place where the high altar was. And this, of course, was extremely shocking to all Catholics, the desecration of the most important church in Paris. And they say, we are for church and king, and we want to restore our old priests, we want to restore the altars, and get rid of this godless regime.
Although the Vendée Rising was already well underway by the time of the Festival of Reason, and the subsequent Festival of the Supreme Being, for which this hymn was composed, it's easy to imagine how reports of them fanned the counter-revolutionary flames.
The status of the priest, of the curé, in the West was much higher than in many other areas. It was the kind of thing that the sons of reasonably well-off families would seek to do, and many of the priests were local people, so there was a bond between them and their congregations, which may not have existed in other places. So I think all these things mean that it is to some degree a cultural rising that you have in the West.
Well, to pursue this question of what happened in the provinces, I'm now on the TGV train on my way to Poitiers to consult one of the French historians who's done most to bring to our attention what actually happened in the Vendée. And while I make that journey, I'm delving into an extraordinary archive. These are the letters of General Turgot, who was sent by the revolution to suppress the rebellion in the Vendée. And his letters demanded exact orders so that he would have cover for the very brutal acts that he was about to commit. And he writes here, Mon intention est bien de tout incendier.
My intention is to burn absolutely everything and to protect only the places where we need to establish safe quarters which will enable us to annihilate the rebels. But these extreme measures must be taken under your command.
The historian I'd come to meet, Jean-Clément Martin, picked me up in his car near Poitiers station, where, poring over a road map, he outlined our itinerary.
Today we are driving from Poitiers to Cholet, crossing invisible border of what is called La Vendée Militaire in Cholet. A huge battle occurred in October 1793, and the little town of Cholet was destroyed.
Although religion was at the heart of the uprising in the Vendée, it was actually sparked off by the government's conscription of 300,000 men from all over the country to fight the wars on France's borders. According to Alan Forrest, the Vendeans weren't alone in objecting. It was their insurgency that set them apart.
Unlike other areas of peasant revolt, this one developed very quickly into armed conflict in which essentially peasant armies led by local notable figures were in armed revolt against the soldiers of the government. They committed atrocities too, let's be quite clear. They captured stragglers, they tortured, in some cases, very horribly. There were stories of Republican soldiers being burned in vats of boiling water, for instance.
En route to Cholet, Jean Clément wanted to show me the remains of the once proud Château de Duvelier, the ancestral home of Henri La Roche-Jacquelin, one of the leaders of Les Blancs, the counter-revolutionary army. As you drive north from Poitiers, the landscape changes. There's an almost English roll to the countryside, and a lattice work of hedgerows, known locally as bocage. In this terrain, a limited counter-revolutionary force was able to operate effectively against the first government troops pitted against it. In Henri La Roche-Jacquelin, they found an inspirational leader. As we pulled up in front of the ruins of the chateau, Jean Clément quoted the speech that he's supposed to have made on taking over as leader of Les Blancs. If I advance, follow me. If I die, avenge me. And if I retreat, kill me.
Mangez-moi. Si je recule, tuez-moi. 10 minutes, okay?
Yes, yes.
We walk through what are now farm outbuildings to the moated remains of the chateau itself.
It obviously was built on a great scale. We're standing by a tower which has been shorn off, but was a very substantial piece. We're looking at some very elegant windows. There's only the frames that are left now. There's no woodwork or anything like that. And looking into the distance, we can see further rounded towers. It's obviously a very large estate. These were rich people.
Yeah, and the Marquis de La Roche-Jacquelin was very influent in this region. And in the beginning of 1793, his son Henri de La Roche-Jacquelin lived there and was put on the head of a little peasant army on April 1793.
So the peasants and the aristocrats came together to make this army?
Yeah, and then on October 1793, Henri de La Roche-Jacquelin became generalissime.
How old was he?
21.
And so with aristocrats at their head, this peasant army fought against the revolution. With some success?
Oui, with some success, because they fight against very bad revolutionary troops in front of them.
The response from the revolutionary government came in the form of General Tourneau and what became known as his Colonne Infernale, the infernal columns of soldiers. As we've heard, the idea was to establish safe areas, and from there to march out to devastate towns and villages known to have supported the uprising. On the 19th of January 1794, Tourneau wrote to the Committee for Public Safety in Paris.
Je le répète, citoyens représentants, je regarde comme indispensable
la citizen representatives, I repeat that I regard the burning of towns, villages and small holdings as an indispensable measure if we wish finally to bring an end to this terrible war in the Vendée. Without it, I will not be able to annihilate this band of brigands, who each day seem to increase in number.
I think what you're getting from Tourneau is an honest assessment of how he can reduce the Vendée to submission. They're being ambushed, very often by men not in uniform. They don't really know who is a combatant and who is a non-combatant. And I think that always makes an army, well, we've seen it more recently, I suppose, in Iraq. It puts that army on a kind of permanent qui vive. They can never relax properly, and it makes them angry. The people who very often were the intermediaries for terror at local level were the deputies on mission sent out from Paris. Now, unfortunately for the West, one of the two deputies in Nantes, Jean-Baptiste Carrier, was a particularly violent man. We have descriptions of the executions, including things which I suppose one would have to call examples of rather bloodthirsty Jacobin humour, in tying together young men and women, sticking them in boats in the middle of the Loire with its dangerous sandbanks, pulling the bottom out of the boat and watching them drown in the river, obviously gave the more sadistic Jacobins like Carrier a certain amount of pleasure and satisfaction. But I should stress that this was not the norm.
Norm or no, it intensified bitterness on both sides and made for a situation quite as dramatic as anything in Paris conjured up by Dickens or Baroness Hawksley. And to my great surprise, there was one English writer who set a novel in the initial period of the Vendée uprising. Indeed, Anthony Trollope's The Vendéans describes the very chateau I was visiting with Jean-Clément Martin.
By degrees, the daylight faded away, and for the last time they watched the sun sink down among the cherry trees of Dobelière. And the Marquis, seated by the window, gazed into the west till not a streak of light was any longer visible. He knew that Dobelière would be destroyed, and it never could be anything to him how the sun set or rose in any other place.
What actually happened to the chateau?
The chateau was destroyed in the winter 1793 by a colon infernal colon sent to destroy the so-called brigands de la Vendée.
If you are a brigand, or worse still, if you're a wild beast, a wild animal, slinking back into the bocage to your lair, and these words are literal translations of the language that republicans used at the time, then you're dehumanized. And if you're dehumanized, then, rather like a wolf, you can be eliminated with less compunction than if you are a human being.
Alan Forrest. Dehumanization of the victims is something I associate with genocide, and historians have debated whether what happened in La Vendée should be described as genocide. I put that to Jean-Clément Martin.
No, because there were never orders to destroy specific population. What the orders said exactly was to destroy les brigands de la Vendée and to put in safety women, children and older people.
Have you any idea how many people might have been killed in La Vendée at that time?
200,000 people were killed or disappeared from one or another reason at that time in the Vendée.
200,000 people?
Yeah.
Killed or disappeared?
Yeah.
Over what period of time?
From 1791 to 1796.
Even allowing for many thousands fleeing to neighbouring provinces, that figure is still shockingly high. The revolution was about the rights of the common man. But while we've retained a clear image of a few hundred aristocrats guillotined in Paris, we've largely forgotten the thousands of peasants slaughtered in the Vendée. To try and make sense of all this, and particularly the way we in Britain have forgotten to remember the Vendée, Bill Doyle had taken me to the Louvre Museum in Paris.
We're looking at the painting by Eugène Delacroix of Liberty Leading the People, painted shortly after the revolution of 1830, but clearly meant to represent an image of the French Revolution that's really founded on the revolution of 1789.
That's absolutely right. Here is Liberty, an allegorical figure wearing the cap of Liberty and carrying the tricolour, the standard of Liberty, which is first adopted by the French in 1789.
Now, at the time of this picture, the British had a very different view of what had happened in the French Revolution. But in the early 21st century, we would, in general, approve of liberty. In some ways, then, we've adopted the principles of the French Revolution. When did that happen?
There's a sense in which we have, but when the French Revolution breaks out, the first instinct that many British people had before Edmund Burke forced them to think about it was the French are catching up with us. The phrase that was used by British radicals is, we were men when they were slaves.
Bliss was it in that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. It's almost the most famous thing said about the French Revolution in this country, I think.
Rosemary Ashton, Professor of English at University College London, quoting from William Wordsworth's long autobiographical poem, The Prelude.
interestingly, that phrase about it being bliss to have been alive at the time of the French Revolution comes in a part of the poem where Wordsworth has already described having gone to France after the revolution, full of hopes, in 1791 in fact, full of hopes that he would find there all the things that the French Revolution was supposed to be about and all the things that he felt he missed at home, liberty, equality, improvement for the poor and so on. And of course he found things were not quite as idyllic as that. So even when he writes about it having been bliss to be alive, he's already writing with a certain weary wisdom that it wasn't to be, that it was not ultimately successful, that the French Revolution went sour.
Let it be said that at the time of the second centenary of the French Revolution, when Margaret Thatcher was our Prime Minister, she actually resisted the invitation to participate in celebrations of the revolution. She recalled it still as a bloody mob. So Dickens and others obviously still exert their influence on her, at least.
That's true, and she took a bound copy of The Tale of Two Cities to give to François Mitterrand. But she also said, we, the British, or maybe the Greeks, she said, invented liberty, not the French.
It is odd that the counter-revolution in the Vendée hasn't really entered into the simple story, at any rate, that we like to tell ourselves about the French Revolution. I suppose because revolution's more exciting than anti- or counter-revolution, it's a fact. Because Paris obviously attracted worldwide attention in a way that the Vendée would not. And the breaking down of the Bastille as a concrete symbol of the metaphorical idea of the breaking down of cruelty and tyrannical laws was really compelling at the time and still is. There were, of course, some hot-headed people who wished for revolution in this country, but most people, I think, including most of the people who've written about the French Revolution, the poets and the writers and the philosophers and politicians of the time, most of them, I think, cherry-picked what they liked about what they knew of the French Revolution while setting aside the less palatable elements, or perhaps just saying, well, that's the French way.
Professor Rosemary Ashton. The last stop on our brief trip through the Vendée Militaire was in Cholet, the small town sacked by one of General Thuroux's colons infernal. It now houses a substantial tribute to the Guerre de la Vendée in its elegant museum, where Jean Clément introduced me to the deputy mayor, Roger Massé.
Michael Fortier.
Enchanté.
Je suis désolé d'être en retard.
Ce n'est pas un problème. Merci. Avec plaisir qu'on vous accueille.
Monsieur Massé conceded that even in France, the Vendée War doesn't feature strongly in revolutionary history.
Je crois qu'hélas, l'énorme majorité des Français n'a qu'un souvenir très confus.
I think, alas, that the enormous majority of French people have only a very confused recollection of the War of the Vendée, of this civil war, because that's what it was, a civil war. Perhaps it's because it remains something shameful in the collective history of France.
In this museum, at the heart of the Vendée, we see many examples of the atrocities that were committed. But what is the first-hand evidence for these atrocities? Were there eyewitness accounts?
Yeah, it is possible to give some testimony coming from a woman, Renée Bordereau, a very young woman, who fought in the White Army. L'insurrection des royalistes de la Vendée en 1793...
The uprising by the royalists in the Vendée in 1793 attracted into our land a republican army who ravaged and massacred absolutely without pity. I saw 42 of my relations perish. But it was the death of my father that was committed right in front of my very eyes that transported me with rage and despair. From that very moment, I resolved to sacrifice my body to the king and to offer my soul to God. And I swore that I would continue to fight until death or victory.
It's a very moving account, isn't it? I mean, it's a sort of thing that we are almost used to from other civil wars, but yeah. The violence, 42 of her relations have been killed, her father murdered in front of her eyes, and of course her reaction, which is that she then will fight to the death. She then becomes radicalized.
No wonder Margaret Thatcher was reluctant to celebrate 1789. For several generations, the population figures in the Vendée betrayed the savage losses. And Jean-Clément Martin maintains that a strong sense of independence still characterizes the region. Shortly after the execution of Robespierre and the end of the Terror, General Turgot was put on trial. His letters, making clear that he'd massacred the Vendéans not in his own initiative, but as the agent of the Convention, saved him. He went on to serve Napoleon, and you can find his name engraved on the Arc de Triomphe. Henri La Roche-Jacquelin died coming to the aid of a Republican soldier. Nowadays, the Marseillaise stirs even British hearts, an international hymn to liberty. It's never been easy for the British to be objective about the French Revolution, and we've swung from one extreme to another. Burke condemned it in 1790 and set the tone for generations thereafter. But with the passage of time, our memory's been reshaped. As Britain became steadily more democratic, we tended to look back on events in France as the forerunner of democratic and egalitarian change across Europe and beyond. Maybe that's why the British generally forget to remember the bloodletting in the Vendée. Alan Forrest and Jean-Clément Martin caution against glamorizing any revolution, if it means forgetting the many thousands who perish in the name of setting the people free.
I think anyone seeking liberation or seeking freedom and liberty in the 20th or 21st century who looks back to the French Revolution as a model will find inside the French Revolution moments of encouragement, general ideas and principles which are very, very precious, which are progressive and which are at the root of our freedoms today. The problem is taking the revolution as a single unmitigated whole and accepting all of it with its implications.
For many revolutionaries in the world, the French Revolution was considered as the model, and for many counter-revolutionarists in the world, French Revolution is also considered as the model of the atrocities committed on the behalf of ideals. But I think that when we are studying a little La Guerre de Vendée, it is possible to understand how the French Revolution was not a model, but was just the result of internal struggles and civil wars. It is the lesson of the Vendée.
The Things We Forgot to Remember was presented by Michael Portillo. The producer was Tom Alban. Well, the series was made by the BBC in association with the Open University.